and I'm from Clark County.
Melita Mosley, Town of Yackel.
Jeff Swanson, City of West Center.
Dave Scott, City of West Yackel.
Pete Fell, City of Kansas.
Julie Wilson, Clark County.
Michael Torres, Clark County.
Samantha Whitley with Clark County.
Rebecca Royce with Clark County.
Jeff Oliver, Columbia, Buzzard Bill.
Amy Love, Pulse Over, Great Habitat.
Thank you very much. Okay, we have approval of the minutes for January 14th.
Move to approve.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Okay, so we're going to move on then to our CDBG at home presentation schedule, and we've got that on the reverse side. I don't know how many people are actually here this morning, but we do our best.
Well, and the schedule actually starts the first presentation at 8:40. You want to wait for 8:40, so
yeah. Comes in. Yeah, is there anything else we need to do between now and then?
No.
We have coffee?
We do. Yeah. Sam, you looked like you were going to say anything.
Oh, I'm just going to let you know that Cherish let us know that she was going to be a little bit late, so she's on her way.
Okay, thank you.
And do either of you guys have anything to add from last meeting with regard to the presentations or scoring or timing or anything like that? You don't have to.
Yeah, well, we did provide staff notes for all of the applications just to talk a little bit about the history of the applicants. So that was going to be
the
on the agenda.
But,
yeah, okay.
Snowstorm, we had snow and ice. It was about 6-7 years ago, and me and my daughter had moved to San Diego with my stepmom for right like between Christmas and New Year's. And so I kept sending my husband pictures of palm trees in the sun.
Oh,
he was,
that's just mean.
It was mean. He still reminds me, and I'd send him weather updates and. Yeah, he still reminds me how mean that was. But, and he, because he was at home by himself, he made it to work every single day and even worked, you know, because lots of guys didn't come in and worked and did like 12-hour days the entire time. He's like, I got nothing to come home for. Might as well.
Right.
And, of course, guys leave 2 miles from the terminal.
They didn't get a vacation after all.
He always finds that funny when he makes it in all the way from Yakult, and guys that live, you know, a few miles from the terminal don't make it.
Yes.
Especially if they're truckers.
Exactly. You kind of, but that's why, because they don't want to be out in this all day.
True.
It's very common.
We had the same car, little tiny SUV thing, cut us off twice today. Our light turned green, and you know how you start going? Well, he was there to turn on in front of us, and he just went. And then the same car, we're approaching an intersection, and we were going to turn right to go down Main and get on the freeway, and he starts to come right at our bumper and come into our lane and change lanes. And my husband's like, that's enough.
Yeah.
Crazy when the weather gets bad.
Yes.
It was beautiful though. There's a lot of snow up there. And I have a St. Bernard puppy who's about 6 months old and a Rottweiler puppy who's about 9 months old now. And oh my goodness. They are having so much fun.
Yes.
I expected my Rottweiler to not like it as much because she has the thinner hair. Oh no, she loves it. She really didn't know that happened. Actually, we can't get them inside. But that's what's nice about being in Yackel is
Yes.
Oh. I do like that about Yakult.
I've been there several times with me. It's a beautiful. Good food. We have 5 minutes for presentation and 5 minutes for question. When you're at the 4 minute mark, I'm just going to discreetly wave the 1 minute card at you.
My name is Beth Oliver, and I'm the Chief Financial Officer of Columbia River Mental Health Services. This project is for funding a variety of improvements at our 32-bed residential treatment facility at Elmont Place. It's entirely within Clark County, and so these funds would come only from Clark County and not Harrisburg City. Elmont Place was constructed in the 1993-94 time period. With a mix of funding, including county home funds. We've met the affordability period for those funds, and the home restrictions have since been removed. Because of the nature of the facility, we have at least annual inspections by the fire marshal, the Department of Health, and at least biannual inspections by the Department of Commerce, which holds the remaining mortgage on the property. We're proud of our overall compliance rate for the facility, and they definitely want to keep it that way. Most clients start their stay at EP with the referral from the emergency department or the crisis team. They have the most serious diagnoses of all the clients that we serve. They are frequently homeless, have zero income, or at most the SSI income of about $770 a month, and are predominantly Medicaid eligible. Our proposed projects fall into two basic categories, safety and maintenance. Our safety projects include exterior lighting and both interior and exterior electronic access controls. These projects will cost approximately $25,400. As with many projects, we expect that there will be additional benefits, including some energy savings for the lights and a reduction in our costs for lost key replacements, which sometimes includes the need to repeat the entire facility. Elmont Place is not a locked facility. That is, we don't keep clients in. They can come and go. They're able to spend time outdoors. There's a seating area, a smoking area, and even a basketball hoop in the parking lot. The lighting is not sufficient for either residents or staff to see what's going on in the parking lot at all times. And we propose to remove 5 of the original fixtures and replace them with LED lighting. We are also proposing the addition of 6 card readers to 3 exterior doors, which provide access to interior hallways where the bedrooms are located, the front door, the manager's office, and the kitchen. Additionally, 7 card readers will be added to conference and therapy rooms, the front desk area, and the linen laundry rooms. These will work with our existing security system and will enable staff to move about the building without needing a set of keys and prevent unauthorized access. Our maintenance projects include replacing the original vinyl flooring, especially the alligator vinyl in common areas. I've put a picture in the packet of that alligator. We wash the floors every day, and so that's only going to get worse and worse quickly as the water seeps into those cracks. And makes it worse. We have a failing 3-door refrigerator, which is losing its temp control and requires constant maintenance. And a roof replacement is scheduled for a total of $8,600 for those maintenance projects. The roof is the largest expense with an estimated cost of $65,000. We've had to repair several leaks in the past few years, and while it's not failing, it is reaching the end of, we think, of its useful life. Prior to 2016, we were able to obtain funding for these items over and above the operating costs of the facility through the RSN, who was able to tap into state funds or other monies for this. Since that time, we've continued to self-fund the improvements. The operating costs are on a fee-for-service basis, primarily with the managed care organizations now. We most recently added improved handicapped accessibility to a bathroom. We've created additional office treatment space out of common areas and added cooling and security to the server room. We anticipate a near future cost of repaving the parking lot, which isn't included in this application, and have recently discovered some deficiencies in our fire alarm system, which we will need to do as well. Again, that is not included in this application. Thank you for your consideration, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer those. Yes?
What year did you say it was constructed?
93, 94. It opened in February of 95.
Because your request is so far below the minimum, it could have been a bigger project.
Well, you know, between the pre-app and now, these additional things we became aware of them. We could add and increase. We'd be happy to increase the application to include those projects. My understanding is in the past the parking lot paving hasn't been an eligible expenditure, but if it is, that's significant. It's about $30,000 at least.
Is there a process for that?
So it came up after you.
Yeah.
Questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So next, and we'll start at 8:50 just to keep us on the timeline, will be Habitat for Humanity. So you have 3 more minutes. And to the UCPB, the reason, I apologize if we're not just moving immediately ahead, but there may be presenters that are coming in at their time, so just to keep it on the same pace. It'll be 5 minutes of presentations, 5 minutes of questions. When you're in the 4 minute mark of the presentation, I'll just briefly let you know.
Okay.
We still have another couple minutes before we start. I'll let you know. Well, with the exception of DVD, it's not a letter they sent us to
Great. My name's Amy. I'm the Development Director at Evergreen Habitat. We are going to be requesting $300,000 for infrastructure development. And I have a really exciting, specific project to talk to you guys about. No time to really delve into some of the aspects of our program, but you know we're an affordable home ownership program. We have an average mortgage payment of about $625 compared to the median two-bedroom apartment in Clark County, which is $1,300. Just to give you an example of the kind of impact our affordable homeownership model is, we have over 1,000 volunteers contribute 15,000 hours every year to our program, so we have lots of people involved in making our projects happen. So the project that we wanted to talk about is a lot behind the Battleground United Methodist Church. They came to us with this opportunity, and it's the first time that we've requested funds from the county with a specific project in mind. We've always had the best intentions of acquiring properties and building more, but we've always just been below the market costs. And now we have an opportunity to really build. And I will send this. I'll make sure that you have these pictures later. But this, if you're familiar with Battleground, the church is by Northeast 199th Street and Southwest 20th Avenue, if that rings bells to any of you. This is 205 here, so I'll make sure that you get these images so you know exactly where we're talking about. The land is currently owned by Battleground United Methodist Church, and they have accepted our offer of $100,000. So we're considering the value of the property a gift in kind. And we suspect official acquisition will happen in late March, early April. Documentation of Battleground United Methodist Church intent to transfer ownership of the property to Evergreen Habitat has been submitted. So it's currently zoned R3. We'd like to begin, we just started our work with zoning change to R7. We'll be meeting with the City of Battleground over the next several months to ensure that that happens. Currently it's zoned for 9 units. We'd like to see it zoned for 25. And excitedly, the Ed and Dolly Lynch Family Fund is excited about it too. And they have pledged $400,000 if we can get the zoning change to R7. So it's contingent on this zoning change. We're gonna move forward with the project either way for 9 units at a minimum. But if we can get the zoning change, it could really be the biggest housing development we've ever done. We're also looking at the Washington State Housing Trust Fund. Stage 1 applicants are currently open. Funding decisions will be announced by the end of 2019, and there's up to $600,000 available. Type of housing that we're going to be doing there, it'll be mixed use, detached and attached. Don't really have time to talk about homeowner selection, but there's a detailed process that I'd be happy to provide some more details if you have questions later about that. We also have 7 potential home sponsors that we like to proposition for renewal that supported our project at $25,000 to $75,000 at McKibben Commons. So we have a lot of momentum from McKibben Commons that we'd like to play into these next developments. We also, as an organization, made a big decision this year to ensure that all property we acquire is going to be permanently affordable. So this is similar to a land trust model. We've just started to look at the trends in the market, and we don't want to be pricing ourselves out of being able to buy our units back. So the details have yet to be fleshed out, but this property that we acquire will be permanently affordable for all the units, 9 to 25. Let's see, okay. Okay, time. You know, I kind of flew through that.
You have any questions?
I just have a comment that obviously I'm very excited about this.
Yay!
About granite.
So even you said mixed use.
Yeah.
Is it attached?
zero lot line attached is what we've done before. We're considering all options. We've seen Portland doing some unique models. We don't have designs yet, but I know that we're considering mixed.
So when you're saying mixed use, are you mean commercial and residential?
Oh, no. All residential, sorry. All residential, just different variations of the kinds of houses.
Okay.
And then, so you don't have a design yet?
No.
This is your largest development ever, you mentioned.
If it's the 25.
Okay. So
McKibbin's is 10.
What's your level of confidence in being able to get it done on time, given the constraints of these grants?
I think we learned a lot with McKibbin Commons. I think we were way ambitious with our timeframes, and now we have more realistic timeframes already in place for our infrastructure development. So we think that we won't begin getting actual foundations in for a couple years with the zoning changes that we need to happen. And we've been working with Troy Johns, Urban Homes Northwest, to sort of look at what it's really going to take to do the development, what funds we have available currently, our revenue sources. I think we're looking at 2 years.
So I assume your layout will be different depending on the zoning, right?
Yeah.
So are you gonna wait for any construction taking place until you know what the outcome of the zoning is? And what's your timeline, your projected timeline for changing to R7?
Josh is our executive director. He's been optimistic that he can get the zoning changed in 6 months. I'd say 6 months to a year. It really depends on how excited City Council is about this change. And it'll be working with Battleground, so hopefully we have some friends up there.
It's probably part of Battleground's annual review, I would assume.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they have comp plan changes.
It's just a rezone.
Yeah, it's just
read our site is the same comp plan designation.
Yeah, it's red for res.
Oh, well then that should take a year.
No, it should take a couple months.
Yeah.
Great. So that just sounded too soon, too quick for me. So maybe a year.
Do you have any feedback from the staff there yet? Do you know what
the staff at Battleground? No, I don't.
You don't know what they've told the exec director about that?
No. Sorry.
Definitely advocate along the way, council members.
Okay, great.
So, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No.
You mentioned that you're asking for $300,000.
Yes.
You said that the Grace Baptist Church offered it at $100,000.
We bought it from them for $100,000.
Okay. So, and then you have a contingent plan if the zoning goes to get another $400,000. What do you foresee the project cost being if it's zoned for 9 units or if it's zoned for 25 units? And how you're anticipating to spend this $300,000 based on that?
That's a really great question. So I have a little one-pager revenue for the infrastructure development, and that's what we have worked out so far. And so that's roughly $1 million, $300,000 of which would be CDBG, $400,000 from Ed and Dolly. So we're counting on that for infrastructure for the larger units, for the 25. And we have some gifts in kind from our engineering firm, as well as our contributions from our individuals and the church. So each unit has been costing us different amounts. McKibbin Commons was our most expensive units to date, and they were nearly $125,000 to $150,000, just the stuff to build the units. So depends on what in-kind resources we can access. We'd love to keep our construction cost per unit down to $100,000 to $115,000, but they could be upwards to $150,000, which we've seen. So,
and do the families that are buying these help build the homes?
Absolutely, 500 sweat equity hours. It's considered the Habitat down payment. It's required in the program.
We're going to have to wrap up. Like, we have just like within a minute left. Sam, did you have a question?
Well, I just wanted to say, since you're waiting on Housing Trust Fund, that's not till the end of this year, and you returned your last two awards that we've given you, wouldn't it make more sense to apply for the 2020 CDBG funding when your project is really gelled and you know how many units and you're ready to spend the money?
Wouldn't it make sense for 2020? Well, I think every source of funding that we can get leverages the others. So we're looking right now at a development work that could potentially take us, it's beginning this year, way into 2020. So it might be hard to start the project without it.
Thank you. And our next presentation is going to be the Hispanic Federal Policy Chamber of Commerce.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well.
Good morning.
And we have 5 minutes to present. When you have 1 minute left, I'll show you that. And we have 5 minutes for questions.
Okay. Good morning. If you don't mind, I'm going to stand.
Sure.
First of all, my name is Gail Castillo. I'm the executive director of the Hispanic Chamber. A little background, I was one of the founders. We only have 5 minutes, so I can't do too much. So this is our mission, and we were started in 1994. Basically, our mission is to support the economic advancement of Latinos in Oregon and Southwest Washington. We do that in three different ways. The technical assistance services that we're proposing to you today, but we also bring much more in terms of our presence in Clark County. We also discuss with people scholarships for their either themselves or their children, and then for those that might be interested in leadership, a year-long leadership program. So what are we proposing? For Clark County, what sets us apart is that we have a staff that's bilingual, bicultural, from the point of the first call or the first contact through the delivery of services. Andrea, would you stand? She's one of the business development coordinators. We have two business development coordinators working on this project. I have four altogether. We have experience in Clark County. We've been working with the City of Vancouver since 2014. We anticipate, we hope that we'll be able to continue that. And then we've had this contract for about a year and 2 months. We have over 15 years of providing technical assistance and the other services here in Southwest Washington. That's that, because people question whether or not we've been active in Southwest Washington, and we have since our existence, because we recognize that Southwest Washington is part of the metropolitan area. It's part of our economic engine, so we have been very active. So, what do the funds support that we're requesting? It's really staffing. It's the direct delivery of services. So what you're funding are the direct services that we're delivering. It's not admin. We're matching the admin. So it's needs assessment, business planning. Really, people come to us very honestly when they have a problem. That's how they come to our door. They're either self-referred, or they hear about us from a relative or someone else that we may have served. We work with banks and insurance agencies that they go to for help, that perhaps they're not quite ready for that assistance, so they refer them to us. So there's a network of people that we work with. So we go all the way from the initial business idea to the actual development and implementation of a plan. And that includes, as you might imagine, permits, licensing. When you're a startup and you have no funds, it's usually, as you know, family or friends that are funding. They're really not eligible for a bank loan. So we have to be creative in terms of how are they going to do it, how are they going to get started, who might assist them, et cetera. And I won't read you all that. But it's all the way down the list. In addition, we put on classes and workshops for individuals. It serves two purposes. One is to educate, but it's also a recruiting tool. So some of the people that we've served, Ana Maria Sanchez, she opened the restaurant. We've helped her with licenses and permits, again, business planning, marketing. A lot of the frustration as anyone would have, is with the regulatory process. So we help them with those regulatory questions and help facilitate. And then Craig Portland, we've helped them as well. Examples of partners and outreach activities. Again, we go to some of these activities not because they're business-based, but because they're community-based. And we understand that they're a source of possible referral. Project summary, we're requesting 61-8. We'll serve 50 clients, and then we get outcomes. So, questions? I did it in 4 minutes.
I have a question.
Sure.
We funded you last year.
That's correct.
To about 60,000?
It was 61. We added just a few dollars for increases.
And then were you able to serve all the clients you anticipated?
We're anticipating serving them. We're in the process of continuing our outreach. Your geographic area is a little bit more challenging than perhaps the city of Vancouver, so we're strengthening our referrals and doubling our efforts in terms of the outreach.
And then how many, so you anticipate you can serve 50 clients? So
right.
How many did you serve last year with about the same funding you
have? We have the same goals, and I'm not sure what the numbers are right now.
How many you actually were able to serve?
Yeah.
And I have just a weird question. On the business in Woodland, was the person live in Clark County?
Yes.
And, but the business was located in
yes.
the city of Woodland in Calvert County?
Saint Paul. I'm not, are you familiar with this one? No.
Just curious.
Yeah.
I don't know. Another question?
Are you planning to do anything different from last year in terms of outreach to bump up the number of persons served?
Yes. I left the chamber, very honestly, for a while. I was gone 3 years, so now December 20th, I came back. And so given my experience in the outreach, I'm doing some training with the staff. I'm contacting some of our partners in the community. We have Hispanic Chamber members in the community, including banks such as Wells Fargo, B of A, et cetera. So between their efforts and my support of trying to strengthen our network, yes, we are mostly strengthening what we're doing.
Thank you
for your time.
And next will be second set housing, and we're going to start at 9, so you have about 2 minutes to set up as necessary.
Thank you. Okay. Good morning. I'm Tim Foley. I'm the Executive Director of Second Step Housing. We're going to be presenting on two projects today, but the first one I'm going to talk about is our CDBG preservation request. So this is who we are. Some of you might be familiar with Second Step. We've been around since 1995. We provide 115 units of deeply affordable housing here in Vancouver. 45 of those units are for transitional housing, people who are coming directly out of homelessness. 70 units are permanent and what I would call transitional to permanent housing. So again, some people coming straight out of homelessness, some households just moving into affordable housing. More than 75% of our units are designated for people and families escaping homelessness. So we occupy this little niche in housing provision that is one step past emergency shelter, and we help people move into permanent stable housing. We're also a community housing development organization. You might be familiar with the acronym CHODO. What that means is that more than 30% of our board of directors live in a low-income neighborhood or represent a low-income community. And that sort of brings a local and authentic voice to our governance, which is important to our model. Partners, as a low-barrier housing provider, we partner with everybody in town who's trying to find housing for their clients. These are a list of the big ones for us. As I said, 75% of our units are designated for people and families escaping homelessness. Today, we're housing almost 200 people in our 115 units, and the circumstances that are common to our residents are what you would imagine. People living with a disability or caring for a disabled family member, people recovering from substance use disorders, fleeing domestic violence, and or living with low fixed incomes. So our properties, we have two large properties that comprise 55 units, and those are our tax credit properties. 60 of our units are in 14 properties that we call scattered sites. So these are duplexes, triplexes, small apartments around town that are kind of scattered through different neighborhoods, mostly kind of close in here, downtown Vancouver. And our strategy moving forward is to do more of these, grow our scattered site model. The two proposals I'm going to talk about, we're requesting $300,000 home funds and $107,500 in CDBG. So our CDBG rehabilitation proposal, I've requested $107,500 to rehab 52 units of our transitional and transitional to permanent housing. So these are mostly shared living situations for people coming directly from homelessness. These units are high use, high turnover, high cost, we collect very low rents. Long-term capital needs are very difficult to fund. The city and the county and the state helped to purchase all these properties usually around 15 to 20 years ago, and the time is now to rehab them because they need an injection of capital. So our goal is to improve safety and increase livability standards and hope that these properties are safe and stable long into the future here. We're talking about roofs and floors and bathrooms, kitchens, fixtures, etc. Other funders that I've approached for the City of Vancouver Affordable Housing Fund, they've chipped in, and a City of Vancouver CDBG fund is a pending application. I think that's all the talking I have to do, and I'm now open for questions.
Questions?
Going once?
Pretty straightforward.
Very good. Okay. Thanks everybody.
Thank you
very much.
Don't worry, I wasn't stupid. That would give you an opportunity.
this is my homeless thing, but I had to like find a place for it at Share. Share flat.
That would be.
Very military. It's a Navy time show.
You have 1 minute left.
I'm
okay. All right, you're ready.
Good morning. My name is Amy Reynolds, and I'm the Deputy Director for Share. And I'm here to talk to you about a rather straightforward, very specific project, our elevator. So if you've ever been to Share House is our men's facility. It's just down the street here. We built it in 1999 to serve 42 men. In 2013, we moved out the admin offices from that building, and so we now serve about 60 gentlemen there. And then during this time of year, we serve an additional 25 to 30 down in the basement. Beyond that, Share House is also the home for our hot meals program. So we serve free meals to the public out of that building. And this past summer, we were going to do a 1 month kitchen renovation. It ended up being a 2.5 month kitchen renovation, but we were able to get private dollars to the tune of about $200,000 to remodel that kitchen. Building itself. If you were to come to Share House and look for services, you would be able to access the main floor, which has the kitchen and the dining room and bathroom. So people accessing our hot meals program have been able to do that year round this past year. But if you're staying at Share House, the sleeping floors are upstairs. So it has a second story and a third story. So there are 30 gentlemen that sleep on the second story. That's our emergency shelter floor. They sleep 10 to a room. And then the top floor has our remaining bedrooms. So in order to access those floors, if you have mobility issues, you need the elevator. And our elevator went down 3 times this past year. So that meant that we had to relocate people who had mobility issues to motels, which is a much more expensive way to be able to house people. And we serve people from 18 to 91. Not that we have a cap at 91, that just happens to be the oldest person who has come to stay with us. We've served World War II vets, we've served amputees, and we've served 18-year-olds fresh out of high school who are struggling with mobility issues. So in order to be ADA compliant and just to be kind to people who have having knee replacements or who struggle with using stairs, we need to be able to have an elevator. We are raising private dollars for this project, and we are also asking the city to help us make this work.
What's the total project cost?
$114,000. I don't know if my question is a good or what, but I thought stuff had to be like in the county area. Is that different for stuff that's
So things that are inside the city limits, the city of Vancouver does have to put CDBG money, if we're talking CDBG funds, into it, and the amount is based on the projected population to be served and where you're from. So that estimate's provided by the service provider, and you know, the total amount of CDBG funding is proportional to that estimate, you know, how much the city of Vancouver puts in and how much Clark County puts in.
Okay, so not just physical location, just the people that are served, that are going there, they're in the county, from the county.
Correct. So by HUD regulations, the area where we are allowed to use CDBG funds, it's known as our jurisdiction, which is basically unincorporated Clark County. So to spend CDBG funds inside of the city limits, the circumstances are pretty limited by regulation, and they need to benefit the residents from the jurisdiction that we're from. That's how we quantify that benefit to justify our expenditure funds there.
Thank you for explaining.
Yeah, people access our services through the Council for the Homeless, so wherever they happen to have previously lived, we're the largest men's shelter in town, and so they generally come to us.
Yeah.
And
we have a very large urban unincorporated part of Clark County. Think about Hazeldale and all the way up I-5 to Salmon Creek. That's all unincorporated Clark County. That's really urban. So.
When you said that it went out three times, was that for extended periods before the operation?
Sometimes for a week, yeah. And obviously, need to be able to provide services for people to be able to go up, leave the building, go up and down, attend to their meetings, or we could bring up meals, but if they needed to leave the building, then we would need to have the elevator. People worried, like, what would happen in case of a fire, and of course, in case of a fire, you don't use the elevator, so we actually have a plan that anytime somebody with mobility issues come to us, we assign two people to be able to carry them out.
You don't have an inflatable slide that you put on the stairs?
We're going to invest in that in the second half. I wish we could certainly... No, we don't. It's a concern. Obviously, you know the history of shares and fires are a big deal to us. The original share house build that burned down in 1996, so we're conscientious about the fire.
So this is an award that has to be duly funded by Clark County and City of Vancouver.
Right.
Without both, there's none.
Without both, the city... For us to invest, the City of Vancouver has to have a CDBG investment. It's within the jurisdiction of the City of Vancouver, so if they wanted to invest without our investment, they could, because it's within their jurisdiction.
But we couldn't do it without that.
We couldn't do it.
When are you guys
going to
know about the Vancouver, whether they invest or not, or did they already commit?
They have not already committed yet. We just presented last week.
Yeah. Peggy, do you know the timeline?
Yeah,
But generally speaking, what's happened in the past, if for some reason the city did not choose to make that investment, we would basically, you know, not expend those funds in this proposal.
Sure.
It would just go to the next ranked proposal that the UCBV chose. And next is going to be Vancouver Affordable Housing in about 3 minutes. So we're going to start in about 30 seconds for your presentation. start with you.
All right, thank you. Good morning. I'm Saeed Hajarizadeh. I am the Deputy Director of the Vancouver Housing Authority. I'm going to present with Amy. She's also Deputy Director of SHARE. I also serve as the Executive Director of Vancouver Affordable Housing Nonprofit, which is a subsidiary of the Housing Authority. And various reasons, there's a couple of board members of the Housing Authority on that board. And we own a couple of buildings, Vancouver Affordable Housing, the Lincoln Place apartments, and Van Vista apartment, which is a 96-unit elderly complex on 13th here in Vancouver. And over the last year, our nonprofits have been talking about how we could be involved in addressing homelessness in the community and see if we could create a place for us. And primarily, we would partner with the Housing Authority to do the development and the conceptual process of putting the a community shelter together. So I have a about a six-page slide show. I'd like to go through it if you could do that. Do I have a phone? Sorry. Okay. So, as you know, hundreds of people in Clark County sleep outside. They sleep in tents, in doorways, and in the bushes. Many outside sleepers suffer from mental illness and drug addiction, and we need more resources to help them. Local governments, nonprofits, faith-based organizations, they all partner together in our community at many levels with a lot of success. Many tireless housing and mental health outreach workers provide assistance on a daily basis to people that are sleeping outside. And so the question is, what do they tell us? And what they're telling us is that we need to provide shelter right now, at least temporarily, to stabilize people before we ask them to stabilize and heal. This next slide, I'll just go over this very quick. Really, I just reiterated what the state house RCW tells us, which is what are the causes of homelessness, and these have been adopted by the state of Washington. Basically, what here we're trying to convey is that no one chooses to be homeless, and there are a lot of different reasons people are homeless. According to the point-in-time count that we did in Clark County, in January 2018, there were 374 persons that were counted as unsheltered. And as you know, we do this point-in-time count every year, and that 2019, the Clark County Homelessness Action Plan that was recently approved recommends that we should add 50 beds in the existing baseline of 180 beds. And of course, SHARE is the main provider of those facilities. And then the most recent point in time count, I've just talked to staff, the numbers aren't out yet, but there's every indication that there are more homeless people that are sleeping outside from 2018 to 2019. So the problem is growing. So I have three more slides, but I only have a minute left. So what I'd like to do is, just if you would, briefly these at your leisure, but I want to, really what we're asking for is for seed money to create a facility to house 50 more people. It's possible that we would partner, because if we're successful, we have a similar application to the City of Vancouver. The facility will have to be within the City of Vancouver, but we know that homeless people are coming from all areas outside of the city and in Clark County. And we're looking for seed money. The application tells you that our estimate is about $1 million. And we are looking for some funding from the city, from the county. We're going to be looking, putting a state house. housing trust fund application, and we hope to, and about half of the rest of it will be raised privately. So if I could, is it my 5 minutes is up?
That's your 5 minutes, but is there any questions?
Could you talk more, so you mentioned it's a $1 million project, you're kind of at the seed money stage, so can you talk about in this funding cycle, you're successful in getting the $355,000, how is that going to be spent this funding cycle?
So we're also, the state housing trust fund application process is similar. So if the state funds the trust fund, which we hope to do, that they do, and that money becomes available July of this year also. So we hope to look to about $250,000 there. And then we're going to, as soon as we hear from some of our public partners that there is willingness to fund something like this, our private partners have told us that they would help us fill the gap, fill the difference. We want to do this as soon as possible.
Okay.
You know,
and so what will you spend those funds on once they're awarded? What's the plan for that?
Ideally, we would have an existing facility that we would renovate.
Okay.
So we would bring beds. We're gonna try to have a women's section to the facility, a few rooms for couples, and the rest for a single men. And we would bring in showers and facilities.
Can I just get some clarification? Are you saying that this is going to be located at the navigation center, or is this something separate?
It's possible. As you know, the navigation center is sort of on its phase one. So about one-fifth of the building now is the day center, and there's quite a bit of room still available in that building. So we're definitely going to be talking with the City of Vancouver to see if that facility could be utilized. But if not, we'd like the flexibility to go somewhere else and find another existing building. There's going to be a lot of community outreach and buy-in that will be needed as part of that process.
So you don't have a facility at this time that you'd be renovating. Would you use any of this money to obtain a facility if you didn't have one at that time?
We're very hopeful that we can work with the city within the Navigation Center. If that doesn't go through, we are going to look for another space.
And would some of these funds possibly be used for that if you needed to?
Yeah. That would
the application is for dollars for acquisition or rehabilitation as needed.
I guess that's my question, is you have sort of a general overall budget, but you don't have any idea really of whether you would use an existing space or acquire a new space or build a building, or so.
We do have a pretty well thought out plan within the Navigation Center. So we have been working with preliminary looking at where they could go, and we have some pretty square foot costs. How many bathrooms would be required per number of people, laundry facilities, things like that. So we've been discussing it with our partners and our the housing authorities development team.
So that would be to do a little rehab in the Navigation Center?
Yeah.
And do you have any idea when that decision may or may not be made?
Same time frame as the rest of this. So the city, we have a request to the City of Vancouver that may be able to, how about we would hear in the middle of March.
So their potential funding would be tied to them working with you in the Navigation Center?
Is that what
you're saying?
Well,
Peggy's
here if you want to.
Peggy's
here.
Yeah.
Do you have any?
Is the request to the city specific to the Navigation Center?
No.
Same request. We're hoping to work with the city. We hope to work with the city.
A shelter in the City of Vancouver, much like our county, requires a conditional use permit, so it's a little bit of a process. Can you talk about that timeline, though? The timeline for a conditional use permit? It usually takes 6 months. Has it already been filed?
No.
So do you know when you'll be filing it?
As soon as we...
And it's a city building,
yeah.
So...
Yeah, we would...
Has to go through the whole process. I'm just looking for, like, a ballpark idea of the time frame. The city will make the decision on the CBG and home funds and public hearing. that you're looking to serve at the shelter?
What we had talked about was serving women and couples without kids. Right now in Clark County, the only time when couples without kids are served has been through the Winter Hospitality Overflow Program. And so women and men who are a couple have had to separate, and sometimes people choose not to, and then they're left outside. So we'd like to address that. And then to be able to be nimble around that as well. That historically, we've built shelters that have been for one specific population, and then things change. So we'd like to be able to be nimble around how we serve them, but there wouldn't be children served in that building.
We are at 9:40, just heads up. Are you presenting for Tenny Creek as well?
No.
Oh, okay. Is there someone from the Vancouver? Oh, you're, never mind.
I thought they had to remove the application for Tenny Creek because they...
Oh. They would...
But this is for Anna Orchards.
Which
well,
she is here
for.
Next
for Anna Orchards.
Okay, so you're here for Orchards. Got it.
Thank you very much.
I said Tenny. I don't know why I said Tenny Creek. I apologize. Thank you, Sadie. Thank you, Amy.
I don't.
My name is Leah Greenwood, and I'm the Director of Property and Asset Management at Vancouver Housing Authority. So going on the theme of shelters, the Vancouver Housing Authority currently owns 3 homeless shelters, a domestic violence shelter that's within the city limits, but serves countywide, as well as 2 family shelters, one on Hazeldale Avenue in the city limits, and one on 4th Plain and 102nd in Clark County. So over the last year, we've been strategizing. The shelters are old. They're 25-plus years. We've made small little Band-Aid improvements over them over the last 25 years, but this year we've been working on really significant renovation plans for them to get us so that we're not coming to both the city and the county every year asking for maintenance on us, but getting to the point where we have solid buildings and then the housing authority is able to maintain them within their resources. This particular application is for Enid Orchards. That is a family homeless shelter, as Amy mentioned, one of our family shelters. It is in Clark County. It currently has 13 family rooms. It has one room that is for women. It's a shared room with single women, and then a unit for resident manager. What we're looking at right now is really doing a significant whole building rehab, and that's doing roof, doing reconfiguring the kitchen, looking at the common spaces. We've been working closely with Cher on as our programming for the shelters has changed, how the physical building is used. So we're wanting to make some improvements that more closely resemble how the shelters are operating. We're wanting specifically to ensure that we have ADA accessibility throughout the shelters, so that includes the restrooms and the kitchens, which is currently not how they're designed. We're looking at things like trying to provide gender-neutral bathrooms, some things that are just changes that are becoming more important over time, and then doing general upgrades. If we're able within our development plan, we may look at adding a little bit of capacity, an extra room or two through some reconfiguration of common space. And then the other thing we're looking at is the shelters often become overflow opportunities as well. And we want to make sure that the rooms that we have overflow folks sleeping in meet fire, health, and safety codes. So kind of that's part of the reconfiguration of the common areas, is allowing a little more flexibility in the existing building footprint to actually be able to serve more folks. Did want to just give a high-level quick overview of the 3 shelters that we're looking at. So our YWCA Safe Choice Shelter and also the Valley Homestead Shared Family Shelter, which is in addition to Enid Orchards. With Enid Orchards, we're asking for $100,000. We currently have an award of, I think, approximately $58,000, a CDBG, and when we came a year ago, we had asked for $150,000, so we kind of just won the whole $150,000. But one thing that's different than last year is we also have a $500,000 award from the state of Washington. So So we now can do substantial rehab. Before, even when we came last year, it was like doing, we were going to do the roof and a couple other things. Now we can do the whole thing. And right now the gap in our budget is about $100,000 to do the full-blown renovation. So we have $500,000 coming from the state as well as the CDBG awards we already have, and $100,000 we're asking, which would be a full budget. I did want to note that the city is putting significant investment in our shelters that are in the city limits, as well as the state. So we have right now an award of $160,000 of CDBG funds that will be helping us do a renovation at Safe Choice. And then we have almost $500,000 of affordable housing funds that are being split between Safe Choice and Valley Homestead. In addition, Valley Homestead has almost $500,000 state award as well. So we're really this year wanting to position our shelters to be long-term assets. I'll just say with Safe Choice, we're getting halfway. We'll still have another phase. But that's really our goal, which piggybacks on, and then being ready to add more.
Questions? I was curious what happens with the occupants during these type of renovations.
It's a good question, and I wish I had a very specific answer, and I don't right now, partly because we just now brought the architecture team on, and it's going to be a coordinated effort between our architecture team and the general contractor that we work with. We do anticipate that there will be a period of time that folks will need to be relocated. And that currently is not showing in the budget, and the Housing Authority has committed that if there are any relocation needs, the Housing Authority will pay for those expenses above and beyond the development budget. The time period of if that needs to occur, I'm not sure. We're going to be balancing the efficiency of the cost. I mean, the most efficient way to do it is to clear out the building, let the contractors in, and do it. But that's probably not realistic, and so we'll be looking at how we phase different elements of the project to minimize displacement, and then also livability, too. I mean, there's a level of safety. There's going to be some work that's done that we just can't have folks in the units. In that area, if we're having to relocate folks, what we tend to do is try to put them in long-stay hotels with full kitchen or kitchenettes, so that they're able to actually be able to fit their whole family and be able to have meals at the location. But that is actually a bit of a to be determined, but I think it will be hard for us to do full renovation without some displacement. With that being said, we will find alternatives. So it's not displacement to the street.
Okay. And we have a 10-minute break, so we will start.
Part of our portfolio, if or when that home buyer decides to sell the home, they must sell to another low or moderate income home buyer. So while that original family still builds wealth, our homeowners help future generations of home buyers purchase homes at affordable prices, just like they did. We steward the homes that are in our portfolio. We have still have a record of zero homes lost to foreclosure in the last 20 years that we've been around. And this one-time funding really does create systemic change for that household stability, which in turn can affect then the county's economic vitality. And this investment creates more family-sized homes that become a community asset to be available for future households. So this is, you know, I don't have to tell you much about this, but the Clark County, I mean, the median sales prices continue to rise. These examples at the bottom are not just like examples we pulled out. These are actual families that purchased homes through Proud Grounds program with Clark County support last year. So you can see their average, you know, their area median income, their jobs, what they were doing, and it just wasn't possible for them to be able to purchase a home on the open market without the assistance.
And as these prices continue to increase, as you can imagine, these households are the ones that are most vulnerable for being priced out. That can cause overall family instability, children changing schools, parents commuting farther to jobs, as well as becoming disconnected from their local community support systems, churches, daycares, neighbors, and such. So this doesn't just cause displacement. It really does also lock these families out of one of the traditional ways to build wealth in our country through homeownership. So this request, we are requesting $300,000 this year of home funding to serve 3 more households. We will provide with the home buyer a 2-to-1 match of the county funds. That comes in the form of the home buyer's mortgage as well as additional funding from Proud Ground. We are asking for actually a little bit more per household this year than some of our previous requests, and that's directly related to the applicants that we have on our applicant list that are interested in purchasing in Clark County. Their average area median income is about 48%, which is a little bit lower, and just with prices continuing to rise, we'd like to request a little bit more per household this year to be able to serve some of those lower income households. We found that this down payment assistance program, the way it's structured, with us using the funds to buy an existing home on the open market, is the most cost-effective way. Oh, I'm done. Is that what you're saying? 5 minutes.
You're at 5 minutes.
Oh, right. I'm at 5 minutes. Okay, sorry. I'm almost done. When you look at other costs of doing like new construction or acquisition, rehab can be a little bit more expensive for households. This is a quick, I'll go over our resale. We did have a resale, and I may have talked about this last year, but it kind of highlights the beauty of how the program works. One of our Clark County home buyers owned their home for 2 years. They had to be transferred for a job. In those 2 years, the home increased in value by $55,000, but the home ended up staying affordable through Proud Ground's program and ended up being purchased by a new income-qualified household that earned 60% of the area median income for an affordable price of $181,250. So you could see, and this was without any new funding from the county, we were able to serve this new home buyer. And if we hadn't had the program the way it was structured, the county would have had to come up with about $89,000 to help that second family become a home buyer. Yep. That's it.
I just have a question.
Yeah.
When you talk about building wealth,
yeah,
in home ownership, do they get to keep any of the equity,
yeah,
from the sale?
Yep. So our formula or the model is basically our homeowners get what they paid for the house up front. So not including the grant money, plus 25% of any change in value. So like that example that we had, I actually looked at the settlement statement, and that family ended up walking away with about $15,000. They put down $1,000 in their down payment 2 years before, so definitely more cost effective than renting, I would say.
Yeah.
And they were able to get a portion of that.
How does it work with the second family? As far as how are they getting a benefit when the price of the home goes up? How does that work?
Well, this family here, they ended up actually buying the house. They bought a $270,000 house, but their purchase price was only $181,250. So they actually got a pretty substantial decrease in the sales price.
Is that because there was a limit on the original family's profits that could be made?
Or exactly.
Own the land itself?
Right. Yeah, that's the legal structure.
So Proud didn't actually have to put forward anything for the second family.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, and then this new family that bought it for $181,250, it all starts all over again. So they agree that if or when they sell, they could sell for $181,250 plus 25% of the change in value to another lower moderate income household.
Don't they already have it?
Well, that's actually what we consider the Clark County's investment in affordable home ownership. The subsidy is growing over time, right? And so we consider that just the subsidy that went in to help the second family, even though it didn't have to be a check physically written.
So it would be,
to do it.
If they sold it, that would be the sales price over the 270 for the sales price. I'm trying to look at it.
No, that's fine. It's what we have to think of is we have to disconnect market value from actual sales prices, because the market value is just what's determined by an appraiser at the time, and we do use that value to plug into our formula to determine the price to the next family. But essentially
essentially it's the low affordable price plus 25% of that increase in value. So even though this home was worth 270, the sales contract was 181,250 between the two households.
So this is a self-perpetuating model. How many units do you have in Clark County that are currently in this model?
Yeah, we have 13.
13 total?
With the funding that we've gotten over the last 4 years. And I can't ever remember if that includes. We have one that is still shopping for this year that we were funded last year. I don't think that includes that. So we plan to add one more through this.
And so you're looking to add yet about three, say?
Yeah, that's what we've been trying to do, about three per year.
Thank you. Fred, I think you are next. Fred and Tim.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Fred Dockweiler. I've been asked by Michael and Samantha to review the home apps for the housing projects. Just quick background, I've worked for an affordable housing developer in the past. I've also underwritten tax credit equity, and I currently work for KeyBank Real Estate Capital, and I provide permanent takeout financing on affordable housing projects throughout the United States. So quick background on me, and I'll dive into the first project here, which is Second Steps. Six-unit acquisition. They've requested $300,000 of county home funds in concert with some city home funds. The Affordable City of Vancouver awarded them funds for the through the Affordable Housing Fund, for those of you that may be aware of that. And then they've potentially contemplated a bank loan to complete the capital stack for this acquisition. The six units are yet to be determined, and they will be added to their existing housing stock. They currently have, and Tim will give you more information on that, but I think you guys own a little over 100 units of affordable housing throughout Clark County. Second step is a CHOTO, a community housing development organization. So within the home funds, there is a set aside for CHOTOs, and I believe that Second Step is the only CHOTO applying for home funds through the county. As I looked at the pro forma, it appears that depending on the resident rents, that there will be some residual cash flow that could be utilized to repay the home funds that they're requesting, or at least a portion of those. So that's always a good feature. Outside of that, I mean, you know, again, we're looking at a to-be-determined acquisition, so there's not a lot else for me to report, but it does feel like if they were awarded the funds that this project would be viable, and hopefully they can find something for acquisition. Any questions for me?
So what I would add, yes, we talked a little bit about this earlier. We have 115 units here in all of Clark County. And our portfolio can sort of be split into thirds. It's kind of a third transitional housing, a third tax credit properties that are kind of their own thing, and then a third of sort of traditional permanent affordable housing. And that's the little third that we're trying to grow here to help balance out some of the costs of our transitional housing, and also to sort of add to that part of the continuum of housing in our community. You know, Cher was here earlier talking about emergency shelter beds. Yes, we need those. We do some transitional housing. Yes, we need more of that. We also need just some more basic, permanent, affordable housing for people. So that's the aspect of our portfolio that I'm trying to grow here over the next few years, and this fits beautifully into that. I think that we're a very small organization, and it's I think that it's an attainable goal for us to look at and say, hey, we can add 6 or 10 or 15 units every year just by chipping away with money from the city and the county and the state when it's available. So that's kind of you know, my approach to all of this. So any questions?
Would these be individual homes? Or
I'd be looking at mostly probably duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes, stuff that doesn't need a ton of rehab. I mean, it's going to need a little bit of fixing, but in a perfect world, we
you already worked with a realtor to see what kind of properties are available or what you expect to be available when this is funded?
I've been watching the market for about the last 6 months, and I've been working with Keller Williams to look at what's available but also what's not available. A lot of times realtors will know sort of, they work with so many different people. Some things come off the market, some things are not yet on the market. So I feel confident we'll be able to find a good mix of properties based on what's available and sort of grapevine stuff. I also pick the brains of everyone at the VHA a lot, so they seem to have kind of an inside track on a lot of things.
Sam, Tennant Creek withdrew, right? I mean, they're not.
Correct.
Tennant Creek is out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the reason I'm asking is we're not in a huge time crunch you know, right now. So if you have more questions, even though we're 10:15, please go for it.
Yeah, I do have a question. So if you're looking to buy 6 units, would they be vacant units or would people be displaced?
Most of what's out there that I've seen is vacant. We're not going to displace anybody.
Okay.
We don't allow displacement.
Okay, good.
The City Affordable Housing Fund has already approved $500,000, and I've got a maximum proposal to the city home, which is $250,000. And then based on what we end up with, I'll fill in the gap with a conventional loan.
Are these family homes? Because usually a duplex or a fourplex will be like 2-3 bedroom
right.
homes.
I would imagine that it'll end up being a mix of ones, twos, threes, probably not fours, those are kind of hard to find, probably not studios, those tend to be hard to find. Yeah, we'd be looking households of, you know, two or more.
Mm-hmm. All right, one more question. So you say permanent affordable housing, is it going to be, do you expect it will be the same people staying in there long term, or is this like going to be a lot of turnover?
Could be. Yeah, no, I mean, with permanent affordable, if the renter, as long as they're eligible, they can stay there. We have properties where people have been there 5 years or longer.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks, Jeff.
So we don't have Tennant Creek, and this BBT, who is doing the Grand Boulevard project, is not coming today due to weather, but they did send a flyer, or not a flyer, but they have an information packet that they asked us to distribute to each of you. So if you see this, you know, 3-pager with map and pictures and stuff like that, that will have the information they would present on. But Fred, would you mind starting with your analysis?
Yeah, absolutely. So what Vaughan Bay and Trillium are proposing is a 26-unit project on a site that I believe they've owned for quite a while. They were allocated credits in the 2018 round from WishFIC, 9% tax credits, and they've been working with Boston Financial as the potential investor, as the limited partner in that deal. They're requesting $100,000 in conjunction with another $100,000 from the city, the LIHTC equity, and then WCRA has given them a letter of intent for $1 million perm loan, which, based on the letter that I reviewed, the updated letter, I don't think it was attached in the original application package. Those are at market terms. They're going to target large families and families that have individuals with disabilities. This project, I have to tell you, for a 26-unit project, 25 of the units will be targeted for 0 to 50% AMI renters. The other unit will be for the manager. But for such a small project, this does have an elevator. It's a 4-story design, and if any of you know the site up on Grand Boulevard, it's pretty tough from a topography standpoint. So, you know, the fact that these guys have owned it a while, they're committed to the project. Based on my analysis of the pro forma, there will be residual cash flow to repay the home funds beyond the WCRA perm loan. And I can just tell you, I have personal knowledge of Bombay Construction and Trillium and Cambridge Management. They own and have developed properties all across the country in thousands upon thousands of units, and they have, based on the response that they gave to Sam, about 600 units currently going in Washington and Oregon right now. So very committed and capable developers, in my opinion. Any questions?
Can you speak to why they only applied for 100,000? Do they really need that money?
So when I look at their development pro forma, which looks like it was developed some time ago, you know, and based upon the site, which is going to be pretty difficult, plus the addition of an elevator, you know, I guess my response is maybe, right? I mean, I could certainly see, based on the budget that they presented, where they might. But I would probably ask them for an updated, you know, pro forma in terms of their development costs. As far as I know, it is, yeah. They've been working with the city. And truth be told, I sit on the city's prioritization review committee. And when they presented Peggy, I believe, had indicated that they'd work with them to get that. So. Yeah.
What is their process for applicants? Like, how do people get in there?
So, I mean, Cambridge Management, which I think they said in their application, manages about 12,000 affordable, strictly affordable units nationwide. They'd indicated that they'll work with a lot of the local folks in terms of getting referrals. But a project like this, to be quite honest with you, word of mouth is pretty effective when it comes to affordable projects like this. And so they go through the process of actually verifying income. There's a lot of paperwork involved. But if you look at the rent delta between what they're going to charge, somewhere between 0 and 50% AMI rents, and where the market is currently in Vancouver, it's well worth the paperwork.
So they have to, they have to hit those area medium income population targets to meet their low-income housing tax credit requirements. So the question is not going to be like, is this really going to go to be affordable housing for households who have low income? It will. You know, it's going to be how do they get the referrals? You know, and as far as I know, it's going to be a, you know, just general basic application process like you would to a landlord. You have to provide your income information. It will be going through some, there's an onus on the property management to do that income verification and recertifications to meet the low-income housing tax credit requirements. But it's not like referrals through coordinated entry and stuff like that.
Were any of the other ones that we talked about today?
Not for affordable housing. Obviously, shelter, anything that's in a homeless crisis response system, yes. And tenant-based rental assistance, the projects that we will be discussing, you know, next, yes.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And with Teddy Creek bowing out and the Grand, we actually have about 30 minutes before Janice is scheduled to present. They're not here yet. So.
By the way, you guys will get, I do a full report on an Excel spreadsheet. You guys will get those as part of the process. Thank you.
Rebecca and Sam, I'm not forgetting anything, am I? Okay, just making sure.
Thank you.
That's true. Yes, you can please use the time, but as Sam mentioned, it is a good moment to go through the staff notes that we prepared for things for you to consider as you're reviewing the applications. We actually taken the time to and have had staff discussions on what's the history of the applicant with the home and the CDBG funds, if it's applicable, like what is the performance of what they told us they would be doing compared to what they're actually doing and what are their success rates. So I hope it's useful as you're evaluating proposals.
And actually, that is on our agenda to do after everything's done.
Well, we can do it now.
Do you want to do it now? Go over the staff notes.
Do we want to discuss it, or you just want to read through and ask questions as necessary?
Well, I guess my question for staff would be, we're reading through this a little bit, I think, as we go, but is there anything that we specifically need to pay closer attention to when considering what applications we're reviewing?
Go for it, Tim.
Anybody?
So the infrastructure projects are pretty straightforward. We just looked at what cities had been funded in the last couple of years and how their projects went. Ridgefield is still underway on their 2018 project, so that's something to consider when talking about awarding them 2019 funds. Everybody else that applied for an infrastructure project is like ready to go as soon as they get their money. Under the social service projects, Columbia River has had a couple of projects in the past remodeling their service center on Fourth Plain, and those, there were no issues. As I alluded to when I was talking to Evergreen when they were up here presenting, we've awarded them funds in 2016. They couldn't spend them, gave them back. We awarded funds in 2017. They didn't meet their timeline, couldn't spend them, gave them back. So I'm a little bit skeptical. It seems like they still have some things in motion for a 2019 award, but I guess maybe if you don't have any insight on the City of Battleground zoning question, because that seemed like that could be a couple of months or many months or.
Well, Jeff might know.
I guess I can speak to it from historical experience, right? So the zoning, the rezone would be a pretty easy process to go through because it doesn't require a comp plan amendment. It's residential or residential from R3 to R7. They will have, and if they're going to build a 25-unit subdivision, they'll have some significant planning, engineering, stuff to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, Meadow Glade. So it's kind of on the north end of Meadow Glade.
But isn't it like 104th, whatever the road that like?
No, it's Southwest 20th and 199th.
Yeah, is it the United Methodist Church, right? There's a Christian school and then the church?
Yeah, the church is a little bit further to the east or west there on 199th, but the surrounding residential uses are large lot subdivisions,
yeah.
Rather.
And it's county.
Expensive. Some of it's in the city.
Yeah, well, that's, yeah.
There's
that's
kind cool. of a line there where it's the Meadow Glade area that's part of Battleground's urban growth boundary.
So, when you talk about these past applications, I guess,
mm-hmm.
were they similar projects or is this something different? Like, should we compare it to, like, this project to them having?
I'm remembering one of them was they were going to buy some lots, and we said that $50,000 isn't going to buy a lot, and they said yeah it will, and then we can't find any lots, and so it's like right, that's, we didn't think that you were going to be able to do this, and I guess I have similar questions now that this is the biggest undertaking they've ever done, then how long did McKibben take?
Yeah, so yes, in the sense that I think McKibben's Commons was as visionary to them as this is now. You know, it's just, you know, it's like the next, it's the next step. Our experience with McKibben's was exactly as Sam mentioned. You know, they would really lowball how much they would need for properties, even when we asked, like, don't you think, you know, this would be more realistic? We haven't had enough interaction with this one to see if it's very different. You know, I guess I do question the realistic timeline when we're talking rezoning, platting, stuff like, especially when you get into things like a bigger development. And they don't have, you know, one thing she did articulate is they don't have the funding they need to do their vision. You know, so they're doing the building blocks. So for what us that means is, will we actually start spending any of the funds they're requesting in the next 2 years? You know, like how many extensions are they going to ask for? And are we going to be in a situation where they end up saying, no, we can't spend it, and then we have to reallocate it somewhere else on a tighter timeline?
Can they spend it on things like planning and design, system development charges, that kind of stuff? Or
I think and for our purposes, if they get their rezone, they've gotten a commitment from a third party for $400,000. So that provides some financing to get them moving if they've decided on what project they're going to build. So from a timing standpoint, I guess for our perspective is, do they need the money this year? Can they spend it this year? Are they in a place where they're going to be able to actually have that planning and process done in order to be able to use the money that we could potentially provide them? I have a question about that.
Well, the other thing to weigh is with other applicants, what's going to put units on the
Absolutely.
Out there sooner,
right?
You know, pay for planning, design, and you pay for construction units.
And considering they don't know about the rezoning, that's probably easy enough, but you still have to go through all the process. And,
9 or 25,
right?
Yeah.
But they still get the land for $100,000, right?
Yeah.
So
that's good.
That's,
awesome.
It is promising that they actually have the land rather than we want to buy some houses. We don't know what houses.
I mean, from a judgment perspective with regard to the project, I don't think that's really the question. Is it valuable and should we fund it? It's just a matter of
should we fund it this year? Makes sense.
And, you know, the other piece is with any of these discussions and all these notes, the intent is not fund this one, don't fund that one. The intent is you have that in mind when you make the decision. So if you decide to fund it this year and we have this conversation about reallocating next year, you have context for this discussion. You know, that's a big part of it as well.
Trying to think about which questions we score where that dynamic is the context for the scoring, how we express that in the scoring. I know there's one about do they know what they're doing? There's a question
do they know
what they're doing, but I don't remember a question about they're going to spend the money and time.
Mm-hmm. So there is a question specifically, it's question number 8. It asks how the funds will be used and then describe the task and time frame of the project.
So that's how
allotted to that specific question.
So that could be the timing context. Okay.
Do we have a copy of the scoring rubric?
Yes. It's in Zoom Grant, so like when you read the question it tells you like the actual points for each question.
Okay.
So that's Evergreen.
Yep. Hispanic Chamber, I had a discussion with her that they had only served 10 businesses with $60,000 last year, and I was surprised that she wasn't sure when she was up here presenting because they had proposed to serve 32. They did have some staff turnover, so I think it was a hard time getting outreach. They just, so their 2018 program was January to December. That was with 2017 funds. And then you guys awarded them 2018 CDBG funds, so they just started those in January. That'll go through December. If you award them 2019 funds, those actually will start January 1st, 2020. So I'm hoping that they kind of pick up some momentum. They didn't meet their target for their 2018 contract period.
But they have this woman back.
Mm-hmm. The demographics.
Demographics.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So historically with our home funds and CDBG, we have underserved populations, you know, minorities and populations of color. You know, when we look at the percentage of people in poverty in Clark County that these funds are supposed to get to, who's being served by the programs that we're funding. So one success that we have had with the Hispanic Metropolitan Chamber is that, you know, that has helped us increase, you know, the communities of color that are being served. And they're not restricted to serving people that are of, you know, Hispanic background, you know, ethnic background. But they do have some cultural insights to help with the outreach. Mm-hmm. So that's another piece to consider.
And then Second Step Housing, Tim is fairly new to the agency, and it was really a lot of work to kind of turn it around, and he's still on the path forward. We just noted that it's going to require a lot of technical assistance on our part, but and it'll have to receive funding from the city for us to fund it. The share elevator is the same way with the joint funding. They need to receive City of Vancouver funding in order for us to fund it. The Vancouver Affordable Housing Shelter Project, as you also heard of the discussion of the timing, we don't think that their timeline is probably going to happen this year. It's hard to say, and I kind of tried to have a conversation with Peggy and Saeed afterwards, and Peggy said, well, you award the funding, and then they figure out the project. And I'm like, no, that's not really how it usually works, but there's obviously a need for the emergency shelter, and he said he wants to get it going as soon as possible. I'm just not sure with the public process what that would really look like.
Yeah, I do have concerns. This is not a reason not to fund it. You know, the reality is this community needs more emergency shelter beds, and it needs it as soon as possible. And we want to fund emergency shelter beds. Like, I want this project to succeed. My concerns are, I don't think they are being Vancouver Affordable Housing, and to a certain extent the City of Vancouver, is being realistic in terms of the community. If they do it in the Navigation Center, I don't think they have started doing, and they've realistically made plans to start doing, the level of community outreach in the neighborhood that will be required to establish a shelter there. So aside, you know, the issues are, you know, in terms of timeline, zoning and community buy-in. And I think, you know, realistic, and I've done shelters before as a nonprofit director. And realistically, I think that if today the City of Vancouver said we are all in and we're going to do a shelter in the Navigation Center, and publicly announced that they would be at least 2 years out before they open it. And they're not even close to publicly articulating that. So that's my main concern in terms of the expenditure of these funds. It's not whether it's needed. It's not whether it's a worthy cause. It's not even whether it's viable. Is it viable in the timeline? And the other piece is, you know, they're asking for, they're stating a need for about $1 million. They get to about $500,000, $600,000 in terms of everything they're asking for, and they're counting on the gap being private donations, you know, just happening. And I have absolutely no insight in terms of what their level, you know, how much community commitment they have for that gap. They're going to have some similar, you know, separate advisory board, you know, there are similar questions in terms of their operations funding. You know, even if you get there, how are you going to pay for like $1 million a year for operations funding? And I don't have those answers yet.
Question though, when you talked about the Hispanic Chamber, you said that their grant is for money that they're going to spend in 2020.
If they get this 2019 award, it would start January 1st, 2020.
Yeah, so like for these two projects, you know, and especially I think the Evergreen one, that's the thing, they're not going to probably spend any capital dollars in 19, probably going to be in 20.
Yeah.
But is that a different criteria?
So for our programs, we like to run them on the calendar year, and we usually get our HUD funds in July, and we can't run everything on a calendar year. So for the construction ones, we really need to have them kind of ready to go in the summer when the funds are released, because we do have a timeliness question with HUD. And every year in May, they look at how much money we have on hand, and if we have more than 1.5 times our entitlement, which we're usually fairly close to that number, then we start having to do extra reporting. HUD says, do you really need this money? And then if we fall behind the timeliness the second year in a row, they can recapture our funds. And so we give the programs the calendar year, same with the tenant-based rental assistance. And but for the construction projects, we try to get them hopping.
And if you remember, absolutely, and if you remember, we had a discussion in the past year about we were concerned about our ability to meet the timeliness criteria. And we did. We squeaked under that wire.
But let's not make it difficult on ourselves. Right. We don't have to.
Right.
Yeah. And I think in this case, in particular, I just didn't feel like they had a really good sense of what they were doing. I mean, I think they know where they're going, but they didn't. But there was no ability for them to know they're going to the navigation center, or they need some facility, or they know what their budget is, or they have no idea.
So I was just going to make a comment about that, that they had an opportunity this past week to open up as emergency
that's a reflection of where they're at in terms of their community buy-in and in terms of that neighborhood. You know, this is not a statement of judgment of whether or not they should have those concerns. I think, you know, there's some really good reasons to be concerned about their constituency and being responsible to, you know, to those individuals that live around the day center. But I don't, you know, personal opinion, I don't think that they're in a place with that relationship,
well,
you know, to be like, we're doing this.
Lord Jim just across the way.
Oh, it's not necessarily just the neighborhood then.
No, it's across the board.
Do we know what our total CDBG funds this year? How much, what we have?
We don't know the total, but we're guessing the same amount as last year.
Which was
1.3.
No, that's the presentation. Yeah, it's we usually split it roughly 50-50, so I think 400,000 for construction, 500,000 for social service.
Okay. But if we didn't fund everything, that's that money would go to the bond fund.
Yeah, you could shift. You could, yeah. And the last one on the front page for social service is the Vancouver Housing Authorities. This was the request that they put in last year. It wasn't fully funded, so they didn't get started. They got the state award, as she talked about, and they just need this little extra that would make them full from last year, and they'd be ready to get under construction on the Orchards Inn.
So the AP money, the $58,000, was that returned?
No.
They
it hasn't been contracted, and it hasn't been recaptured. It's just like waiting for them.
Okay. So basically, they're building it up.
Right. So with 100, they'll have 158 for this project.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. One thing that I wanted to quickly discuss, we brought it up earlier when it was asked, but I've had about 10 different questions about this in the past week following the City of Vancouver presentations, which is, can we... we being the county, and how and when and how much spend CDBG funds inside the city limits of Vancouver? Because we've been getting that question a lot, and the kind of questions of, well, why are we only spending this amount in the city of Vancouver with CDBG funds with the Vancouver Affordable Housing shelter piece? Like, why is the county? Amount $150,000, the city amount, like this, you know, shouldn't the county do more? And, you know, just for your education, if you look at the UCPB policies for funding, you know, mention earlier, Clark County is its own jurisdiction for CDBG funds. The city of Vancouver, when they, you know, like we used to be a single program, the city became its own entitlement with its own CDBG funds. So what that meant, by federal regulation, we do not have a say in this, is the city of Vancouver became its own jurisdiction. And they received CDBG funds directly from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, which are meant to be spent in their jurisdiction. We receive our, you know, CDBG funds that are meant to be spent in our jurisdiction, which means the unincorporated area around Clark County. Generally speaking, grantees are not supposed to spend their funds outside of their jurisdiction. Federal regulation does allow it in very limited circumstances. And what those circumstances are, is that it's supposed to benefit the residents of that jurisdiction. So anything that we spend outside of the of unincorporated Clark County, it has to benefit the residents that are living in unincorporated Clark County. And also by federal regulation, it is incumbent on us as the county to be able to justify to auditors and to HUD, if we ever do spend funds outside the county, why we did it, you know, how did we determine that it was benefiting our residents, and to justify the amount of investment. So the way we did that, our HUD CPD office, our program representatives, asked us to have a formal policy, and we came up with the policy based on what other jurisdictions that have similar dynamics do on proportionality, which means that we will make an investment of CDBG funds in proportion to the city's investment based on what is the projected population to be served by that facility in that location. So using like the emergency shelter one as an example, they, if you look at the application, they projected to us that 30% of the population that would be served, their last known address was in Clark County, unincorporated Clark County. So as long as the city of Vancouver spends CDBG funds in that facility, we can spend CDBG funds in that facility, and the proportion would be we would spend 30% of that total CDBG ask. That's how it is. And, you know, so I just want to make sure you're aware that's the reason for that. CDBG funds are the only funding source where we make that proportionality limit. So like document recording fees, homeless crisis response system stuff, we do not have those limits. These limits are driven by federal regulation, and we don't really have much flexibility. And another, you know, the only other thing I'll tell you is that during state auditor's office audits, we have been asked, why are you spending CDBG funds in the city of Vancouver, and how much you're spending, and how do you justify it? And the policy has worked to justify it. So,
Michael, when you say unincorporated Clark County, you also mean the city that
are
not entitled.
Correct.
So
non-entitled
cities. Anywhere in the county that's not the city of Vancouver.
Correct.
And then, I think we, those of us that have been sitting on here for a little while, understand the Woodland dynamic, but there's a slightly different dynamic there. But Woodland participates, it's in Cowlitz. Oh, it's also in Clark, but they don't participate in the Cowlitz program, they participate in this program. So the Cowlitz money comes here from the federal government.
No.
And we disperse it into
so Cowlitz is not its own grantee. So Cowlitz County is balance of state. So there's a pool of non-grantees. All the counties are not grantees. It goes to the state, and they apply for competitive grants to the state.
Right.
So, but we have, let me sure, make sure we're still good. We're still good. We have 7 minutes before Janice.
Do you want me to cover the home notes?
Yes, please.
Oh, did you have more questions? So on the home projects, Proud Ground, they luckily for them have a hot real estate market, and they can always use more funding, and they always spend our funding. We have had no issues with their program in the past. Second Step Housing, as they noted, are they only CHOTO, and we do have a small CHOTO set aside that if they are not awarded funds, that would just sit until next year's applications. The 15% of home funds, I think, works out to about $40,000. So that would be unallocated if we didn't award Second Step. The VBT folks, Fred said they were excellent to work with. We've never worked with them before. It seemed like a low effort application, but Fred said that's because they have so many thousands of units that this 26 unit project didn't warrant a lot of their time, but they're going to knock it out and they're going to be awesome. So I was glad that he had experience with them because we didn't know anything about them. On the three TIBRA applicants, Janice Youth has, as we noted, required ongoing technical assistance to get their reporting and invoices correct. Their last contract was for $125,000, which they proposed to serve 40 households. They ended up serving 23 households, and 20 were able to exit the program. 17 went into permanent housing.
That's not a bad rate.
That's a good success for the permanent housing.
Yeah.
Lifeline Connections, like we mentioned, they just started their program January 2019. They got the 2018 award, so they started January 2019. And I haven't seen anything from them yet. They didn't bill for January, so they're probably just kind of doing the outreach and getting their program participants together. And then SHARE has historically always had a TIBRA contract going back years. Their last contract was for $400,000. They proposed to serve 54 households. They actually served 86 households. Only 24 exited the program during this period, and it's an ongoing, it's a rolling period, so they can be into the program for 2 years. And so only 24 exited within the past 12 months, and 17 of those exited to permanent housing. So, and we put the note down here that we were looking to fund only one TIBRA proposal this year. However, with Tenny Creek dropping out, we'll just see what the scores look like and what you want to decide when we look at it at the March meeting. Tenny Creek, Fred had done a lot of work on it. Michael and I and the VHA had all looked at it and worked on it and how was it going to work with assisted living, and we thought we would have a way forward with HUD, and then we realized after all of this focus that we've had it on, how does home work with assisted living? I talked to him just late last week, and he said, well, these are all public housing units, which you can't invest home funds into public housing. So I said, well, can we just split out some units to be home units and the rest can be public housing? And he said, no, that's not, because for their operations, they needed them to all be designated public housing. And I had missed that. Fred had missed that. The VHA had missed that when they put in their original application. But that's an ineligible project. I've taken it out of Zoom grants. Or I've declined it in Zoom grants, so you won't have to score that.
I just had a question back on chair. Is there anywhere that it's noted, like, how many of these people are unique individuals and not just from going from one funding program to another?
If I understand your question correctly, it wouldn't just apply to SHARE. It applies to any of our programs on HMIS. When it's an exit to permanent housing, it's generally speaking, not going from one program to the next. An exit to permanent housing if it's going to continue to be subsidized, it would have to be a permanent rental subsidy program for it to count as a successful. So if you see a rate of success of in any of our programs, not just SHARE, that it exited from the program to permanent housing, that is an exit from the homeless crisis response system to, unless it's to permanent supportive housing, which is a permanent, you know, subsidy, it would be an exit to a permanent housing solution.
So I think that I'll try to ask it differently. I don't know if I'm asking it correctly. So, like, how many of the, they propose to serve 54 households.
Mm-hmm.
Are those unique, like, new people that haven't been part of the system, or could they already be receiving some other funding from another program and get transferred over, or they do, like, more individuals instead of just swapping programs?
And I guess to that same question,
sure.
Are the 17 that exited the Janus program, the 17 that exited the SHARE program, unique and individual?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just curious, because I've heard, like, where they go from one funding funding source to another?
So I cannot speak to before they entered the SHARE program or before they entered the Janus program, if they entered from a different program or not. I cannot speak to that. Other than, we do, with all our tenant-based rapid rehousing, we do require them to be rapid rehousing programs as defined by HUD, which prioritizes households that are homeless. So the odds of it wouldn't be going from a transitional, either unsheltered emergency shelter or transitional housing entering a rapid rehousing program. So like if they were not off the street, we'd really be looking at a population that was coming from shelter or transitional housing. It's not impossible for it to be rapid rehousing, but that's really how the prioritization works. The 17 households that exited to permanent housing from Janus there is no overlap with the 17 households that exited from SHARE. And in terms of how many individuals that means, we didn't break out for you how many individuals exited permanent housing. We did break out to you how many individuals were served. But we can, break out how many unduplicated individuals are in each household. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Doesn't
Council for the Homeless also serve as kind of the data?
Correct. They do all the...
And
all of these programs go through coordinated entry. So the referral has to come from and be accepted, from Council for the Homeless Coordinated Entry into the Rapid Rehousing Program.
So it is possible that some of those households are still within their 2 years of service, so they're not necessarily brand new from that year. But rapid rehousing is only allowed to have up to 24 months worth of assistance. So at some point within 2 years, those brand new households coming in, and those would be the priority populations of shelter or.
But we are at 10:56, I want to be respectful of our time. Are there any other last minute before we bring in Janus for her presentation? Okay. So Janus, we have 5 minutes for presentation, 5 minutes for questions. When you're doing your presentation, when you're 1 minute out, I'll show you the 1 minute. Yes. Thank you.
I'm Scott Conger. I'm the Housing Program Director, Janus Youth Programs.
Dennis Morrow, I'm Executive Director for Janus. And thought we had a PowerPoint, but that's why I never trust them. So So, from an introduction standpoint, we believe that this program, the NEST, is a necessary component to any community plan to actually be able to end homelessness long-term in the community. Now, it's the only youth-focused program that's funded by city or county, and Janus, actually, our entire agency is a youth-focused agency, and we're the largest provider of services in the Northwest for runaway and homeless youth services from Portland all the way up to Cowlitz County, where we now have programs to do this. Our programs range from outreach to drop-in to hotel vouchers to eviction prevention to high-risk youth. The NEST is a chart that we had. I'll see if we can get a copy for you. But the NEST is one of a number of programs, and the idea is every youth can access the level and type of service they need to be able to get off of the street, get into a program, and ultimately to end their homelessness. I'm going to talk about this program.
So this program itself specifically is a housing program to house hard-to-reach, homeless, high-risk youth. What we do is we help them get off the streets and get into housing. And a lot of what we do is building trust with youth. A lot of the youth that we serve don't trust adults, won't use the adult system, don't want to have contact with adults. So that's why this timeline, but the flow chart that we have, where we have an outreach program to a drop-in center to housing, is it's all building trust with these youth so they actually access services. So Janus has come to be known as a trusted organization throughout the community. A lot of youth won't go to adult organizations just because it's kind of scary for them to hang out with adult homeless individuals. So that's the importance of having this program itself. And we've, like it was mentioned, we have an 85% success rate of people becoming housed and being stably housed. a lot of what we're doing now too is peer-to-peer mentoring. So a lot of the youth, so these youth are hard to reach homeless youth. The ones that you see on the streets that are, that used to hang out at the bus stop and they hang out at Estes Shore Park and all around, across the community. And what we've done is help focus on these youth to help them get housed before they become the adult, or graduate into the adult population, wherein saving the community a heck of a lot of money for not having to pay for emergency rooms, jail time, all a whole bevy of costs to the community that we're saving just by accessing or getting these youth housed before they enter the adult system. And what we've seen too is, so at our drop-in center, this program was developed because at our drop-in center we used to see the same youth come in over and over for years from the age they were 14 and then not access services, and at the age of 25 they graduate to the adult system and we never have the opportunity to house them. So that's why we developed this program. And it was highly effective in the sense that a lot of those core youth that have been there for years are no longer there, and they're acting as role models for the other youth that come through the community. So what they're doing is assisting youth that, you know, they see that I can do this too, so they're all working together to get all these youth that they call families off the street, and it's really effective. And it's part of the reason that we didn't serve the number that we thought we were going to serve, because the needs are just so high. But one thing we will say is that the effectiveness is 85% effective for hard-to-reach homeless youth, and that's keeping them out of the adult system. And these are the ones that used to just graduate into the adult system and cost the community a lot of money. So
many of the youth are actually youth families, so we look at 30 households, but that represents 40 to 60, and that's something that even caught me off guard when I first started doing this work. I was thinking of homeless youths running around like they're by themselves, but most of them actually have young kids.
Families, yeah. I think we serve 55 individuals, so of the 21 households, a lot of them have families and kids, and we're helping them stay off the street too. A lot of the youth that we do serve, so we have an HMIS system, a homeless management information system, which gives you a number. And a lot of the youth that we serve have numbers below 20,000, which means that they were in the system when their parents were in the system. So they were actually homeless youth as children. And they were trying to stop that cycle before their children become homeless youth as well. So the effectiveness of it, as I said, is just astronomical. We've never seen any program that we've had such a big impact on the homeless youth community. We help a lot of people that are becoming homeless or recently become homeless, but these are the street entrenched youth. We're trying to catch them before they graduate into the adult system.
So we're actually seeing visibly fewer of this high-level youth on the street, and we have the same thing in Portland, whereas housing programs have come online in Portland, we've seen a diminishment of about 400 a year in terms of entry into the system down there. The other chart, and again, we can just leave these and you can make copies, but the other chart we have is like the hourglass chart, and basically this starts up here and says youth outreach, we made 30,000 contacts with homeless youth, but we made 3,000 contacts with 800 different youth in the county last year. And then it shows you as they work from the outreach and the drop-in into a housing program. We call this the trigger point. They get a case manager, like in the NEST program or one of the other housing programs, and then they start participating in services. And what I want you to think of is we talk about return on investment. The county requires an annual report with a return on investment. When we calculated this year, I used some federal rubrics that we had not used before and applied them, so actually using standards in the federal government sense for money that we get directly from them. And the determination we reached was a single NEST youth who exits homelessness, which means they do not graduate into adult homelessness, will save our collective communities for a male $2.1 million in lifetime savings and for a female $2.7 million because she has additional costs because of her kids and foster care and health for those.
Great.
So that means one youth here, 2 million in the future, 30 youth here, that's a $60 million savings minimum to these communities. And that's why we think it's important to keep a youth-focused investment as part of the package.
Any questions?
What's your request for this year? Does this say 100,000?
100,000. And we work with the city too, so the city will do 60,000. And with this allocation, you only get 20% for case management, and we need intense case management for these youth. So we've requested 45,000 case management from the city to compound with this 20,000 so that we can provide the services needed. The intense case management, make sure that these youth do become self-sufficient.
Do you have a target number of households for this next cycle?
20? Is what we went, ended up
30.
Two.
I think
we
said 30.
I think we went down to 20 this year, yeah. Mike and I, 20.
So after that, so you got a little bit of basis based on your first year.
Right.
Yeah. Because again, the subsidy can go federal review just in December, and they looked at us compared to programs around the country, and they said actually programs Janus is operating in Clark County and Multnomah, we consider national models, and in some cases you were 20% above the average that we're seeing in other programs working with these kind of kids. So youth are a higher risk population, usually don't see this level of success, so I just feel very proud of Scott and the team that he's put together to do that work for the community.
Aside from the technical support that we thank you. I think we were addressing, we had some troubles with reporting that. I was really hoping that one of our staff could do, but we decided to change to a different staff. So.
Do you feel like you're not
going
to that hurdle, that reporting and paperwork hurdle that you have a sense of?
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, we went back in and pulled the record, so we can actually get you back.
Thank you.
All right.
And we have a Lifeline next.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you, Janice.
Yeah.
In Lifeline, we have 5 minutes presentation. At when you have 1 minute out, I'll let you know, and then we'll have 5 minutes of questions.
Yes. And then that'll go forward.
Thank you. I have handouts as well. Thank you for letting us come and speak with you. I'm Jerry Shoemate. I'm the Fund Development Director for Lifeline Connections. And this is Debbie Peabody. She's our Housing and Employment Supervisor. It's a new position, a new function, and a new department for the agency. We've been looking at doing housing really for the last year and a half that we've gotten really deep into it. But let me give you a little background about the agency first. Lifeline Connections has been providing treatment for people with substance use and mental health disorders since 1962. We serve about 4,000 people a year here in Clark County. Many of our folks have long-term substance use disorders. Many have serious mental illnesses, and many of them have both. Our commitment really is to meet people where they are on their journey of recovery, and our goal for each person is recovery. Behavioral health disorders are completely treatable. People recover all the time. In fact, about 10% of adults in the U.S. report that they are in recovery. So chances are you know someone who is in recovery and who's living a strong and healthy life. Recovery isn't easy, and when you're homeless, it's even tougher. More than 90% of our patients at Lifeline are low income or very low income. Many have been or are homeless, and as we'll discuss, safe housing is absolutely essential to achieving a strong recovery. So our request is for $75,000 in home funds for tenant-based rent assistance and $12,500 in CDBG case management funds. These funds will support security deposits, application fees, utility deposits, and rent assistance for 15 households of people in early recovery from substance use and mental health disorders. All of our housing services are provided under a recovery housing model, which means that in addition to case management, we offer treatment, peer support, and other recovery-based services. It may be evident that people with behavioral health disorders often experience unique barriers to housing, but as you can see, the problem is pretty profound. Just under 9% of the people in the U.S. have a substance use disorder, but nearly 40% of people who are homeless have an alcohol use disorder, and that's just alcohol. 4% of Americans have a serious mental health disorder, but 30% of people experiencing chronic homelessness have a serious mental health disorder. A study in Boston found that individuals experiencing homelessness were 9 times more likely to die from an opioid overdose than those who were stably housed. As the National Coalition for the Homeless notes in this quote, homelessness and behavioral health disorders are absolutely linked. There's no question that each is both a cause and an effect of the other, and so they need to be addressed simultaneously. Our proposal seeks to support people by providing housing and strategic services for folks who have some of the biggest barriers to stability and self-sufficiency. Recovery housing, I mentioned a moment ago, is a nationally recognized model that meets the criteria of housing first.
if entry into the program is designed by the individual and is by the individual's choice. There are minimal barriers. Treatment plans are designed by the participant, and relapse is not an automatic cause for eviction. Recovery Housing Works, Central City Concern in Portland, recently assessed their own recovery housing program and found that among program participants who graduated from their treatment programs, 89% had maintained their new housing a year later. Lifeline is now providing an array of housing support services. We've just opened our first men's recovery residence, and we're currently building funding to purchase and open a women's recovery residence. We support people in housing at Meriwether Place. We're administering rent assistance funds through other targeted projects, such as the state's Offender Reentry Community Support Program that helps ex-offenders who have a history of complex mental illness and violence as they leave incarceration and reintegrate into their communities. It's important to note also that we refer people to and support other recovery-style housing resources, faith-based organizations, Oxford Houses. These are sort of well-established housing opportunities for our population, but they don't serve everybody. For example, Oxford Houses don't have the capacity to serve people who are using medication as part of their treatment, which is the gold standard for opioid use treatment. It's simply not a part of their way of operating. So this is one of the things that we can offer through our housing services, is really that extra support for folks who don't fit into those others. Do you have any questions?
So you stating that those who graduated your housing service, 89% of them maintain their housing within 1 year?
I'm saying,
or are you saying statewide or national? What are you saying?
That's a figure provided by Central City Concern in Portland. Our housing program is actually quite new. Our tenant-based rent assistance funds just became eligible to us contracting-wise in December, so we don't have statistics yet for our cheaper funds. There's a page here on Medicaid 1115 waiver. I know sometimes there have been questions about how we can do case management on $12,500, and we actually have other resources that can help build out a full position.
So would you do any of this recovery-based housing assistance prior to so you just got your money this first time, right?
Right.
So this is your first year doing it, so you haven't done it before.
Right.
So did you assist tenants prior to that through these other agencies that use
It was more informal. We didn't have a formal housing program, but we did it through case management, through peer support services, our clinicians. Yeah.
So could you still have an official housing program and work with other tiers, work with other resources that maybe have tenant-based rental assistance dollars? Is that, I mean, or do you have to have your own dollars to have your own program?
We certainly can, and in fact, we are. I think this offender reentry program is one that is, we've got the funds that are coming in to support those tenants. We don't actually, I don't remember if the funds come directly through us or not, but we use those. It's really more about that service level for this population that doesn't necessarily get that particular bent of treatment and supportive services.
How do you get the population that you're going to serve?
Can I talk about referrals?
Yes, Council for the Homeless Housing Solution Center does the intake process with each of their people that are seeking that support. But one of the criteria is if they're receiving Lifeline services, anything from they're staying overnight in our sobering service program because they have nowhere else to go and we want to help take care of them, to full treatment. So if they are engaged with Lifeline at all, that's where we're getting the referrals directly from Housing Solutions Center.
So would you serve anyone that was not currently a Lifeline client?
We would definitely offer that. However, they are basically giving those referrals to the other agencies that have TBRIF services. If they came in and said this person is interested in receiving treatment at Lifeline, whether it's mental health counseling or just housing case management, we would definitely accept that. But they are sending out the referrals to other agencies if the person is not engaged or doesn't want to engage in substance or mental health services.
more about targeting, I think, than restricting.
Right. But so to be clear in my mind, the individual would at least have to be interested and willing to engage in substance or mental health treatment to be eligible for housing?
Not to be eligible. It's really more of...
To be referred.
That's how the referrals are coming.
So they would not be referred if they were not?
Correct.
Okay.
Because the other services are out there for them.
Okay. I guess I don't understand the difference between eligibility and if I'm not going to be referred unless I express interest, how is that different than not being eligible?
My understanding of the system is that it's what we're choosing, what we're offering through our housing services is this additional level of services and care. It's not a closed door if you don't want it. It's just those referrals aren't coming to us.
Okay.
Question. So when you're using rental assistance, are you using it to pay rental assistance at your own units, or is this going to be, could somebody live anywhere and they mm-hmm. pay it? It's not like a revenue source or anything?
Correct. It's targeting for sort of scattered site.
Wherever the person chooses to live, we can provide the full service of searching, retaining, as well as treating their mental health or substance use disorders. And I think the Housing Solutions Center sees that as a benefit for many of the people that come through, whereas like they probably can't refer out for somebody who's actively using substances where there's no treatment for that.
So do they have to be, I think maybe this is what you're after, do they have to be receiving treatment to be eligible for the money? Could they just go and maybe be a client of Drug Court or something, have to use Lifeline for testing? Could they be
right.
eligible for that?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah,
treatment is not a requirement to be to receive housing services. And we have people who maybe at one time were associated with us, want housing, are coming in, don't feel like they need treatment anymore.
Mm-hmm. So would Council for Homeless and this is going to be short because I do need to go over the chair, but so would they make a referral to someone that was not a Lifeline client or did not articulate that I want to be in this treatment, would they make a referral to you?
It doesn't sound like that's the protocol, and I don't
but,
know.
But so where I'm struggling with this is the Council for Homeless makes its referrals based on the criteria and the guidelines that the service, the housing provider, tells them to provide the referrals. So if that would exclude them from making a referral to you is because that's what you're asking for. That's where I'm confused.
If we received a referral that was not interested in Lifeline as expressed to the person making the referral at Housing Solutions Center, when they came to me, I would definitely ask them if there was any other services, whether it be supported employment to work on being able to pay their rent long term, or whether they needed maybe to check into detox or sobering while we're looking for housing. That would be an option, and I'd ask them if they'd like that service. I don't think we would necessarily turn anyone away. We want to help everyone.
Okay.
And I'm sure that I can't imagine most of the referrals saying, I don't want anything else, when obviously they do need some type of wraparound service to maintain successful housing. If they've been homeless for a long time, there's some skills to be learned there.
Okay. Well, we do need to go to share.
There is some contact information on the last slide here. If you feel like it's appropriate within your parameters to follow up, please feel free.
Thank you.
And Chair Tom and
Talia.
By this presentation, when you're at 1 minute out, I'll give you a visual cue, and then we'll have 5 minutes of questions.
Hello.
Hi, everyone. My name is Talia Crawford. I'm a case manager for the Aspire program.
Assistant Housing Director for SHARE, Aspire.
Thomas Breidenbach. So the Gulliver. I said my name.
Thank you.
The Gulliver program is to ensure that our participants are stably housed and moving towards self-sufficiency. Our focus of our program is to hold our participants accountable to achieve that goal while working with them and providing the level of case management that they feel they need or that they ask for. We are a trauma-informed care agency, and we aim to carry out this model throughout every interaction with our participants. This funding is used for intensive case management for the clients receiving rental home subsidies. Case management is an integral part of our program. It's where we do a lot of our work. Well, it is our work. It's where everything kind of happens. Our caseloads are typically 20 to 25 households. This can be individuals, families, single mothers. The participants pay no more than 30% of their income towards their rent in order to help them move towards self-sufficiency. We meet a minimum of once per month with them. More times than not, they ask for multiple times so that we can help address the needs that they have. We use a strength-based model for case management. As it's by our case managers, we assess, plan, implement, coordinate, and evaluate the options and services that are required to meet the client's health and human services needs. During this, we also maintain a trusting relationship with them, so that way they see us as a support system and that they can come to us if they're in need of extra services. We assess our client's short and long-term needs. It allows us as case managers to understand what their goals, strengths, and skills may be, and to best meet these goals, we create a housing stability plan with them. The idea of the housing stability plan is to set realistic and achievable goals in a timely manner. Some of these goals can pertain to employment, physical health, mental health, budgeting, child care, parenting. Sometimes they want to go back to school, so it would be those kind of goals. Many of our clients either receive outside services or wish to do so, which means that case managers act as a support or mediator in helping them navigate these resources. More times than not, they find themselves lost, and so they don't really know where to go, so we help with that. Also, part of this Aspire is our work with our landlords. We work with over 100 different landlords, whether that's apartment complexes, property management, private landlords. We aim to work more with private landlords because they seem to be more forgiving in the screening process and aren't as strict, and they're just easier to work with getting our clients housed. One exciting thing is that we also have two housing search navigators, and so the housing search navigators work really closely with the clients once they get referred into our program. They help them address any barriers they might have, how to navigate those barriers, how to apply for housing, because a lot of them don't even know where to start. They transport them to meet with landlords, and so on. Sorry, I'm really shaky.
It's all good.
After our clients are housed, the relationship with the landlord continues with the case managers. We like to build that relationship because then it helps us advocate for their needs more, and if something comes up, we already have that relationship in place and the landlords are more forgiving or more understanding with the client's circumstances. To ensure that they're also stably housed, the program conducts housing quality standard inspections of any potential units to make sure that they are safe and stable. We also have some classrooms at the Frumhold Center where we utilize them for numerous types of classes. We have a 6-week tenant education course called Rent Well, where we teach the clients their rights as a tenant, how to apply, also how to address their barriers. We hold monthly supportive service meetings monthly supportive service meetings throughout the year that also have various goals such as finances, employment, child, like summer resources, like anything that the clients bring to us that they want. We help with that. We also partner with WorkSource to provide employment services. They occupy an office in our building once a week, so that way it makes it easier for the clients to access those employment services because it's more in a central location. Overall, Aspire aims to continuously support our clients and help them move towards self-sufficiency so that they can stay stably housed once they exit the program.
And I might add that over the last couple few years, we've been serving the more harder to serve clients lately in addressing homelessness. And so we've really adjusted our program to try and help with that process. That's where we get the housing navigators, because a lot of them have significant barriers. And we see a huge difference in how who gets housed and how quickly by having that in place. And we also make sure that all of our case managers are well trained. And we just work really closely. Sometimes we'll have a case manager more than once a month just to try and help them through their struggles. And so we've seen our success rates go up this last year. And I think that we've made a lot of successes in serving the hardest to serve clients in Vancouver, so in Clark County.
Any questions?
Coordinated entry system.
So if you, I'm just trying to piece these last two together here. So do you work with Lifeline at all with regard to tenant-based rental assistance? If they have folks that they're working with in terms of substance abuse or behavioral health? Or
we do. We would refer people there. And so, and then we, with an appropriate ROI in place, we would collaborate with them to with services.
Oh,
so
with rental assistance.
We wouldn't pay rental assistants for their program. We would have they might be seeking Lifeline services, and we're having them housed in one of our our programs.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out how we try not to duplicate our services and our efforts. And so where these programs can coordinate, I guess it's kind of
where and we also work with all the other mental health and service providers also, and we try to refer out as best we can. We assess the needs of the client, try to figure out what their needs are, and refer them to places they would feel most comfortable accessing. So.
I have a question.
Yes.
It's kind of based on some personal knowledge from people I've worked with. When people exit your program, do you help them leave, I guess, exit? Like, say, if their income increased, would you just give them, like, a 30-day notice and kick them out?
So for the home program, the good thing is that with the 60% AMI, so we have quite a while to work with them as they transition off. We usually give them at least ample notice before we just cut them off.
What would that be?
Well, depending if they were over FMR or not. And so generally, if they're not over 60% of the AMI, then not FMR, AMI. Then we would transfer them off slowly over several months.
Okay.
So if they're over, then we may transition them off quicker because they no longer qualify at that point.
So I had a friend that was told to leave the program at less than 30 days and then ended back up on the streets and back in drug addiction. So I was just curious if there was a different plan for that.
They might have been on a different program than
one of your own units.
So we have we also have wraparound housing funding, which is only 30% of the AMI, and unfortunately, it is difficult sometimes for people to sustain on 30% of the AMI. And so I would suggest that it's most likely that program that they may have been transferred off, because it's a much slower process for the home and CDBG programs. Wraparound housing under the CHG guidelines requires that we reassess them every 90 days. And so it could be when their dining aid review comes up that they may be over income and we can't serve them moving forward. So that would be one reason it would be a short notice, because it's out of our control. We wouldn't want to violate our contract, our CHG guidelines. But for TBRA, it's 60% AMI, so they should be fairly well set if they become over FMR. So, and we give them budgeting tools. We refer them out to the housing resource, Lighthouse.
Lighthouse.
And we make sure we wrap around services as much as possible before they ever get to that point. So, and we try our best not to graduate people early. So that would be the only circumstance I can think of. I'm not saying it didn't happen. I'm just saying I don't know why else it would have without knowing for sure. Was it a conflict with the landlord, too? I mean, that meant another reason why.
It's made too much. They were working on bettering themselves and they got a job and then they were given 30 days notice but they didn't have anywhere to go. So I'm just worried about like people that, where do they go after that if they're not technically able to go anywhere? Does this program help with that?
Well, so what we will do too is if the person doesn't have enough money with and they're over FMR and they can't afford the place that they're living out, we'll try to help them transition to a new place that they can't afford. And we look at that when they first come in, and we try to emphasize that with our housing navigators. They try to emphasize that also that they need to find a place that's affordable, that they can, when they're off the program, that they can continue to be able to pay that. So we spend a lot of time looking for affordable housing options for people as best we can. It's limited. It is limited out there as far as what's out there is affordable. The rents have gone way up over the last couple of years, and so for a single mom with children, it's extremely difficult for them to be able to sustain moving forward. And so, without knowing more of the circumstances to why that happened, I couldn't tell you exactly.
I will, and this is not a defense of Share or any any other housing service provider. I will just say that in terms of the eligibility criteria for the funds, the service provider really does not have much of a say, and. We, as the county, if we're talking consolidated homelessness grant, state dollars, we're talking HUD dollars, or even document reporting fee dollars, which we use consolidated homelessness grant guidelines, once the household no longer meets, they're no longer eligible for the assistance, the rental assistance that they're getting, it's very limited what a service provider can do in terms of to mitigate that. In the period of service that they're in, the service provider might try to put wraparound supports as much as they can to anticipate the things. But once, so I'm not defending, and I don't know many solutions that we can have. Like just the reality of. We have to have, with public funds, eligibility thresholds, and we struggle with that, in general. HEN, not this program, but Housing Essential Needs has been notorious for people who are really and have income restrictions and limits and needs being cut off because they lose eligibility based on what DSHS will say.
So it'd be interesting at some point, it's probably not totally relevant to this, but to see how many people actually fall off and then interact with the system.
We do see that. And actually we can discuss that offline. So we also measure for every program the percent, like really the grade, how we measure success of a rental assistance rapid rehousing program is a percentage of exits to permanent housing, of successful exits to permanent housing. So, everyone that leaves the program, where did they go to, and what was the outcome? If we're talking permanent supportive housing, what we're looking at is retention and recidivism. And in all programs, we do track the recidivism, meaning are they falling back into homelessness? Do they come back within a 2-year period from being served by that program? So we can have those discussions.
If someone's getting rental assistance and then their income level increases and so they're no longer eligible for it, they don't necessarily have to move out though, do they?
Oh, no.
They're just paying the rent themselves at that point.
From day one, we try to, with our years of experience, try to predict how likely they're going to be able to succeed in a certain place. We try to place them accordingly, and we also provide wraparound services around them, budgeting, mental health services, chemical dependency services, anything that we can do to try and help them sustain, because that's ultimately our goal. And so I think that we do a pretty good, and then even more so now that we have a housing navigator to help us.
We are over time.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
So in our schedule, we were going to have next is a discussion of things to think about when grading. We largely had that discussion. Was there any follow-on or anything, any loose end on that before we wanted to move on? Yes, and that's part of what we're trying to do there in the notes, is that's why we're saying, you know, number to exited the program, and number to exited to permanent housing.
And, like, what the definition of permanent housing is?
I can send you the list, but basically, and when I say I can send you a list, HUD, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, there is an actual list of destinations that can be considered permanent housing. Falling back into homelessness, transitional housing, general couch surfing are not exits to permanent housing. It has to be a permanent housing solution. So it could be permanent supportive housing. It could be a Section 8 voucher, something that is a permanent subsidy. It could be the household can afford the housing independently, you know, because their income increased. It could be a family member agrees to for the person to live with them permanently and put them on their lease. You know, so there's a list of what that can be considered, but it's pretty specific.
Would a link to the Homeless Action Plan also be beneficial?
Sure.
Have some of that data in it?
It has some, and we can provide it. You're asking for performance measurements.
Just because I've seen some of the programs out there and known people that have utilized them, so I'm just curious what the actual results are.
Absolutely.
And I don't know if they do it, but I like the idea of seeing the unique individuals. And then my mind kind of started to go to what if they were somebody that failed the program, then re-entered the program. I mean, I'm just curious, like, how many new people are we serving and getting into permanent housing, or they're not failing these programs, and then we're getting into another program and funding them again.
I can't say. So we have a Rapidly Housing Work Group that is all the housing programs for all of our Rapidly Housing programs. Nationally, the reserve rate is up around 20%. For our community, it's about 1.9%. It just went to 2.1%, but we're having right around 2% reuser rate for coming back into the system within 2 years of exiting any of our Rapidly Housing programs.
So the placements to permanent housing at our Rapid Rehousing Program, community-wide, it varies a little bit, you know, service provider, you know, project by, program by program, but it's about 90% successful exits to permanent housing. With that recidivism, it's a 2 years after exit, right around, did you said about 20%, Rebecca?
It's the national average.
And what did you say ours was?
We didn't. Right about 2%. We have between 1.5%, I think it's been as low as 1.4% up to 2.1%.
So where we have a big challenge in this community more is how many new households, which is a little bit of what you're alluding to, how many new households can enter the system to receive subsidy at once? Because a lot of our dollars are spent in that 2 years, you know, like, so let's say we say $600,000 of rental assistance. When we make that decision and start making those funds available, there will already be some households that are receiving rental assistance that a good portion of that $600,000 will go to for the next, you know, 12, 24 months. So the amount of new households that can enter the system is limited. So we have a lot of households that are eligible and in need of a service, but there aren't new resources to provide that service.
And one thing to keep in mind is that we are asking our housing providers to serve households that are going to need. Instead, it used to be 6 months on average. We're asking them to serve households that are going to take 12, 18 to 24 months on average, just because of the nature of the barriers that we're they're going to be serving. The rapid housing reports that I put together for this work group also include the number of days within the program. I think that might help you with seeing how fast that turnover might be at frame of the average length of the program stay. So we can provide that information.
I'm not trying to get, like,
no,
into the weeds.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All very interesting, and I want to make sure we only get to choose one, right?
Well, it's up to you.
Okay.
I have a question about that. We have a couple of minutes. I just kind of wanted to understand staff's reasoning on that. You know, I'm looking for overlap. I completely understand this dynamic about not spending the money puts the program at risk. Janice sort of said they're on top of it. Now, you know, looking at overlap, and they're asserting that their clients, that constituency, is not served by the SHARE programs.
I think that's
in
true.
Theory, because they won't approach those programs. Whereas the Lifeline program, there seems to be that there might be a little bit of redundancy. What has the Council for the Homeless, the Housing Resource?
Housing Solutions Center.
Lifeline was asserting that they get these referrals. What's the perspective from that organization around this issue of having multiple TBRAs? Do we care? But they're just making referrals.
So
they're the entry point. Right?
So the Housing Solutions Center, we've not had a discussion with them about the funding source as much as what is the reason of the referrals and what are the restrictions to come with the referrals. So, you know, the Housing Solutions Center has not given us feedback about, hey, for home this year, for home TVRA, only select one TVRA provider, select two. They do express concern for situations where a service provider wants to restrict the services they're providing to their clients, to a very specific client. We have heard that from the Housing Solutions Center about Lifeline in terms of a concern of Lifeline wanting Lifeline clients to be referred to them for housing as opposed to having rental assistance funds available to as broad a population that needs that rental assistance, and then have them access the services they need. So I have had that concern expressed by Housing Solutions Center, not about the funding source, but about the mechanisms by which referrals and eligibility is determined. We have asked Lifeline to clarify for us, to assert and state that you're not restricting your services to your clients, that you are designing this program to serve people who are experiencing homelessness as opposed to people who may be housed in some other way. They have done that. It is not clear to me that that's necessarily the case for exactly what you saw, which is Lifeline is making referrals to you based on your criteria. You're telling us they're only referring to you clients that are either your clients or they're interested in your services. So I think there's a little bit of a disconnect there between what they're saying as opposed to what the reality of how that would play out.
So to make sure no one's falls through the cracks, Lifeline has a client, they don't need TBRA assistance, then they find themselves in a situation where they do. I can see where Lifeline wants to just be able to wrap around that and say, oh, we've got some TBRA money, here you go.
Sure.
But what they can do is they can refer them to SHARE.
Oh, they could.
So they're an existing Lifeline client, they need TBRA assistance. Oh, well, we have a partner. And then vice versa.
They would have to go through the Housing Solutions.
So they refer them to
correct.
The Housing Solutions Center.
The Housing Solutions
Center
to the
connect them with the other partner.
Yes.
I'm a SHARE person on a constituent at SHARE. I was referred by the center. And at SHARE, through case management, I need substance abuse help. They will refer them to Lifeline or others.
Correct.
To provide those services. And so that synergy all works.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to figure out why does Lifeline want to do a TBRA thing. It's just easy. It just makes it easier for them because they still have to go through this center.
it's a lot easier to get treatment when you get housing, and it's a lot harder to get housing.
Okay. Okay. So you're saying, is that pro or con?
Well, it is, you know, it is what it is. You know, I mean, you know, what I hear from the Lifeline presentation is they're looking for resources, more resources to serve their clients. Good resources, real legitimate needs, you know, it would be a benefit to the community. You know, that's, generally speaking, with our homeless crisis response system, we want our resources to go to the people that need them, with as few other, you know, organizationally imposed eligibility criteria as possible. You know, so
our funds are required, they cannot require that participation. It's housing first. They cannot require other supportive services. So
what about age then? Is that an issue for the Janus TIBRA?
No.
No.
In terms of eligibility?
Well, the Lifeline question around concern that they are gatekeeping when they shouldn't gatekeep. Does Janus gatekeep as well?
Well, so that's a really hard question for me to, like, honest, you know, give you an honest answer. The, you know, nationwide studies say, you know, credible, is that youth are a pretty distinct population with pretty distinct needs. So it is incredibly helpful to a community to have organizations that really target that population. So, you know, with Janus, I don't really question the need to have an organization that targets a population like that. And that is also directions in which the state and the federal government have been moving in terms of, you know, the data shows that this, you know, these kinds of programs are helpful to the community. The challenges that we've had with Janus are really among the amount of technical assistance that, you know, they've needed on an ongoing basis. I mean, I cannot describe to you the number of staff hours that we spend every year, not just with their reporting, but with their invoicing, with performance measurement, and I don't see that stopping, you know. So the question to think about, you know, is there overlap between Janus and a more generic program like SHARE? I don't really think there's overlap. Is there unnecessary duplication? I don't really think there is unnecessary duplication.
Whereas you might with Lifeline.
I would worry about that more with Lifeline. You know, with Janus, I think if, as you're evaluating the proposal and you read it, are there other funding sources available for rental assistance that could serve Janus? You know, yes, no, there are. Could they use home TBRA dollars? Probably. I think the biggest, you know, if I were in your shoes scoring, I would look at their history in terms of success at spending the funds, you know, because the need is legitimate, the organization is legitimate. So the question in, as far as home dollars is going to be, are they going to have to extend the contract to do what they say they're going to do, or are they going to return funds because they've been unable to spend them out in the timelines that they're saying, you know, so.
And they ask for less this.
Yes, they did.
So is that their reality check on that last point? We can't spend all of this. We're going to
lower. They haven't done that in the past, have they?
Oh, so yes, their past two contracts were extended. 1 year, 18 months, and 8 months, respectively. And did we do any reductions in funding for it? I can't remember off the top of my head.
No, I don't think so.
No, but they did require extensions.
Can you give them a limitation on staff hours before they have to get it figured out?
As for those of you leaving, please note just the dates of the bus tour. That's the stuff that